I guess I haven't learned how to tune and load an amp, and I really should, because I own a Henry 2K, as you know. I put some battery in, 2MB. Needs a pair of tubes. I'll get a pair of tubes for it. It'll be 500 Cs. They're $200 a piece, which is actually very reasonable, because my favorite tube is the 8877. It's a ceramic tube, but it's very expensive. Those tubes are upwards of $1,200 a piece. But, can't beat a tube amp. They're rugged, and, you don't have to worry that if the, if the designer or the company didn't do a good job on protection, that you'll pop the output transistors. Because if you do, they're super expensive. They're usually modules. A whole bunch of modules would have to be replaced in that case. They're not practical yet. Back to that, and so we go.
One other thing you might want to know about transmitting tubes is that some transmitting tubes, because of improper manufacturing procedures, where either the internal elements were not sufficiently cleaned and they start outgassing, or the vacuum holding glass envelope doesn't have enough integrity and air leaks in there. So when you get a so-called gassy tube, quite often the gas will behave in such a way that the control grid bias on the tube starts moving in some crazy direction, too far positive quite often, or sometimes too far negative. So a gassy tube, because of the conductivity of the gas molecules running around inside of that vacuum envelope, act like a another resistor, either to ground or to the plate voltage. Therefore, the control grid starts behaving pretty crazy. So you may have the proper grid leak resistor, the proper coupling capacitor, the proper amount of drive signal, and the proper amount of tuning. And still the amplifier can go kind of crazy if there's gas inside the tube. And sometimes you can detect that gas by way of measuring the voltages, measuring the currents, and realize that they ain't behaving correctly. Sometimes also in a dark room, you look into the tube while you're transmitting, and you'll see a really funny blue glow, much greater than should be there. These are all signs of gas inside the tube, in which case the tube has to be replaced. And there are a number, there are a number of tube amplifiers where the tubes are being used in parallel, not push-pull, really in parallel. In which case, whether or not one tube is very healthy and the other tube is not very healthy, as far as emission capability, doesn't matter. There are a bunch of manufacturers of tubes out there that will sell you matched pairs of tubes, and they lead you to believe you got to pay this extra money for carefully matched pairs of tubes in this parallel amplifier in order for it to behave correctly. I'm convinced that's not true. Maybe in a push-pull amplifier, matching of the tubes might be required. But when the tubes are being used in parallel, which is one of the most popular ways, should the tubes be matched pairs? I say no. In the case of the K2RIW strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432, where the two pairs, where the two tubes, 4CX250B, were being used truly in parallel, did they have to be matched pairs? Absolutely not. The way I prove that is periodically, periodically, I only wanted half power output, and I would turn off the filament on one of the tubes, but leave the tube plugged in. So it's a pair of tube, parallel tube amplifier, where I turned off one of the tubes. And after I reset the tuning and loading controls, it ran like a charm. You can't get a bigger mismatch than that, of one tube being alive and healthy, and the other tube being completely turned off, yet it's sitting there in the circuit, sucking up signals. Worked like a charm. So, in parallel amplifiers, I've got a lot of experience telling me that careful matching of the tubes is absolutely not required. Save your money. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Okay, well, last week we had a question on matching capacitors. And this gentleman heard that conversation, and you and Eric came up with some good ways of matching it. Now, this guy has a question on matching crystals for comparing the frequency of crystals. He's got a box of crystals, and he wants to match them up to make sure they're exactly the same. What can he build or what type of instrument should he use to do this? He doesn't have much. I know he has this simple stuff, but maybe you can give him a quick idea of how to do that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
One of the most critical requirements I know of where you want crystal, quartz crystal circuits with matched crystals is a so-called lattice filter. There's a way of putting crystals together with other coupling components to make an extremely high performance matched filter. And each of the crystals have got to be on the right frequency in order for that filter to work right. And what are we talking about here? The real series or parallel, I think it's usually series, resonant frequency of the crystal. And you could build a fairly simple tube or transistor type circuit that will make the crystal oscillate. And each crystal design usually has a stated number of picofarads that the external circuit is supposed to present to the crystal. I don't know the exact number, but maybe your particular HC6 crystal, that's a certain crystal holder, or an FT243 crystal holder, where the crystal is supposed to be put into a circuit where the external circuit presents 7 picofarads of external capacitance in order to get the rated performance of the crystal. By way of you looking that up, you can find out what is the rated capacitance the crystal is supposed to see. Let me drop. So you could build yourself a circuit that makes the crystal oscillate with the right amount of loading capacitance, and now you want to measure the frequency. Yeah, the ideal way to do it would be with a frequency counter. But frequency counters, if you bought it brand new, you're spending $10,000, a really good one. You buy it on the used market, you might get it for $300, but maybe even that's a little bit too pricey, but you've got a receiver. With your receiver, you can tune to the frequency the crystal is oscillating on. And by comparing the calibration of your receiver to its internal calibration comb line generator, I mean, some receivers will have a calibrator built into them. When you turn on the calibrator, it'll give you a signal every 100 kilohertz or every 10 kilohertz up the band. And you make sure you compare your crystal calibrator inside your receiver to the 5.0 or the 2.5 megahertz signal of the National Bureau of Standards, as it used to be called. NIST is what it's called today. So by setting your crystal calibrator of your receiver just right, by comparing the correct calibration line to WWV, and then by listening to your particular crystal, you've now got a bunch of calibration points on your receiver, and now you tune your receiver to that crystal. With a little bit of care, you can get a lot of accuracy out of your receiver being used that way as a secondary standard to measure the oscillating frequency of your crystals. And in some cases, let me drop. In some cases, the crystal is pullable a little bit. By that I mean by slightly increasing or decreasing the amount of loading capacitance that the crystal sees, you can force the crystal to oscillate on a slightly higher or a slightly lower frequency. A really good crystal resonator has a basic Q of about 50,000. That tells you how difficult it is to pull it to another frequency. In other words, by way of its very high Q, it really wants to oscillate on a particular frequency or not at all. You and I build a resonator with an inductor and a capacitor, it might have a Q of 50 on a good day. And so a little bit of stray capacitance on that circuit will pull it to some other frequency. You can easily pull it to, 50 kilohertz away. And a real good crystal oscillator on 80 meters, you'd be very difficult to pull it more than 1 kilohertz. It's a very high Q circuit. So in some cases, you can pull the crystal, and maybe you can force it in your circuit to operate, even though you don't have the right crystals. Mel, K2KEY, was building himself some crystal oscillator, some crystal filters, crystal lattice filters. Let me drop. And he went to a surplus market somewhere and got a great big pile of crystals. I think the crystals were on 3.579545. The chrominance frequency for color television. He picked up a whole bunch of those crystals. And he wanted to find 5 of them that were all on the exact same frequency to build his filter. And he managed to do that by doing circuits, systems somewhat like what I'm describing right now. So a crafty ham radio operator can measure crystals, can measure the frequency of the oscillation of a crystal with pretty high accuracy as long as he used some of the techniques that I'm describing. And the ARRL does hold a, I think once every month or so, a crystal frequency measuring competition, where on a particular hour of a particular day, they tell you that in the vicinity of 3.51 megahertz, CW band, 80 meters, they're going to be transmitting a signal with the W1AW identifier. And your style is supposed to measure the exact frequency you think you see. And people go on a list of how accurate they were in measuring that frequency. There's a whole art and science to measuring frequencies very accurately over the air using techniques somewhat like what I'm describing. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. That sounds clever and probably a lot of fun. All right. I think he's got enough information to handle that now. And, maybe he'll come back with a result, and we'll hear how he makes out. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my last question. A little science question from a youngster. Okay, this gentleman has been studying the speed of light in a vacuum, and he had a question on when a light ray passes through a different medium. We know that it slows down, like when it goes through a lens. The question is, when it passes through the lens, does it go back to its original speed, or is it slowed down to the same speed that it functioned within the lens itself? So maybe you can handle that for him, Dick. KC2WGB.
Now, I've often said that a radio signal is blind and a light signal is almost blind. Well, this is one of the cases where it's not blind at all. The dielectric constant of the medium, the velocity factor of the medium that any sinusoidal signal is going through, whether it be a light signal, whether it be a radio signal, the medium itself determines the exact rate at which the signal propagates through that medium. So your signal is coming through air, moving at very close to the speed of light through air. It hits a piece of glass, for instance, because the glass has got a certain dielectric constant. The velocity factor of the glass might be 93%, so to speak. The signal is going to go 93% of the speed of light through the glass. When the signal exits the glass, it instantaneously goes back to the original speed. See, you're thinking in an inertial reference. If I was moving my automobile down the road and it's moving at 60 miles an hour, and I hit a patch of mud and my car gets slowed down to 40 miles an hour, and now I leave the patch of mud, as I now go back to clear road, my car is at 40 miles an hour. It doesn't instantaneously go back to 60 until I apply a whole lot of gas, if you know what I mean. Well, that's an object with mass that you've slowed down. And now you have to apply force to a certain length of time in order to speed that mass back up again. Let me drop. You could make believe that the photons of light and the photons of radio signal have no mass. No matter what medium they are in, with rare exception, they will always travel at the speed that is appropriate for that medium. So when that light wave leaves that glass, where it was moving at 93% of the speed of light, and it goes back to air instantaneously, it is back to the speed of light in air. It is a non-massive item. So it's got a very different set of rules compared to your automobile going through a muddy patch and being slowed down. So thank goodness it does that. There's all kinds of slow wave structures. Let me drop. In the case of light, a magnifying glass, for instance, a lens, a prism, these things have a particular velocity factor at each of those frequencies, depending on the dielectric constant or the velocity factor of, what is it called, a dielectric constant? I can't think of the other word that's used for glass, for that particular medium. Now, there are ways you can synthesize a slow wave structure. That array of directors in the front of your Yagi antenna is a slow wave structure. Depending on the length of each one of those elements, depending on the spacing of those elements, determines the velocity factor of that radio wave traveling down that particular portion of your Yagi. So you can, by modulating the length and the spacings of the directors of a very long Yagi, you could have a fairly high velocity factor in the beginning, a fairly low velocity factor in the middle, a slightly higher velocity factor a little bit in front of the driven element, in which you can modulate the velocity factor of the slow wave structure characteristics of that long string of Yagis. And when you plot the velocity factor versus length along the boom, you get a graph. It's called the velocity profile. When you have a particular shape to that velocity profile, you get a particular antenna pattern of that Yagi antenna. Let me drop. It is the radio equivalent of creating a lens, an eyepiece, where you've got multiple lenses in the eyepiece. You can have converging and diverging and whatever lenses in the middle of your eyepiece, your plossal eyepiece for your particular telescope. Well, it turns out with a long Yagi, you can simulate all of that. You can make convex and concave lenses the equivalent along the length of the boom of your Yagi by adjusting the length and the spacings of the individual elements, of the individual directors. So slow wave structures, if you're an antenna designer of Yagi-like antennas, for instance, you can make all kinds of exotic shapes of the velocity profile along that Yagi in order to give you certain amounts of gain and certain amounts of pattern. You can control the side lobe levels, the beam width of the main lobe, and the front-to-back ratio. You've got an amazing amount of controls in your hand. Let me drop. You've got an amazing number of controls in your hand that you have access to when you're adjusting the directors of a long boom Yagi antenna. By way of setting up that antenna range in my backyard, the ratiometry antenna range, which is one of the articles you can read about. I think that article was in somewhere around 1976, 78, QST Magazine, Ratiometry and Outdoor Range Improvement Techniques by K2RIW. You can see how I set up an antenna range where I could resolve gain changes to the nearest 20th of a dB, 0.05 dB of gain change I could resolve with that ratiometry antenna range technique. It's really converting my whole backyard into one very large operational amplifier. Two antennas being used side by side, and you're comparing the signal strength between the two antennas. One was the standard gain antenna, and the other one was the one that you were tuning, and you're comparing the gain between the two. As such, I had a lot of common mode rejection. In other words, the transmitter could go up and down in amplitude. It didn't matter. The reflectivity of the soil in my backyard could go up and down as it dries out when the sun is rising. It didn't matter, because I was only comparing the signal strength difference between the two antennas with an instrument called a ratiometry. It's really one great big op-amp. You could say one antenna was the negative input and the other antenna was the positive input of my operational amplifier. And so with that technique, an awful lot of the usual error mechanisms of antenna gain measurement went down the tube, so to speak. Let me drop. Got eliminated is what I should be saying. And therefore, I could resolve a 20th of a dB of gain difference. And that allowed me to tune the so-called RIW-19 Yagi, which won a lot of contests and has been used as a standard gain Yagi antenna for the 432 band by a lot of antenna range operating people. And when I started working for the Rome Air Development Center, I was amazed that they had set up on one of the world's best antenna ranges for military measurements and near Utica, New York. It was a ratiometry antenna range. And I wondered where the concept came from by which they had built that. Okay, you got a comment on this one, John? KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Listen. Great. Great information, Dick, and fascinating stuff. It really is. I think there was an excellent question from this young gentleman, but okay, I think it's time to go over to Paul. That's it for the mailbag, and let's see what great information he has for us this week. WGB, back to you, Dick.
A question on the subject.
Yeah, make it a little bit brief, Wes, because a fair number of people have trouble understanding your accent, so keep it a little bit brief. And go ahead with your question on that subject. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, you were talking about the antenna and different velocity factor for the photons transmitted from the antenna. And my understanding was that you were talking about a particle part of the antenna that produced different velocity. Is that correct?
Absolutely. In the case of a very long boom, Yagi antenna, which maybe the Yagi's got 20, 30, 40 elements, and that whole boom might be, in the case of 432, it might be 25 feet long, could, if you want to, by adjusting the length of each of the directors and the spacing of the directors in that particular position along that 25-foot length of the boom, you could make the velocity factor one number in the 25-foot region, the velocity factor another number in the 20-foot region, another number in the 15-foot region along the boom. So when you plot velocity factor versus length along the boom, you get a graph. That graph among the people who do exotic Yagi antenna tuning, that graph is called a velocity profile. So you can adjust the velocity factor along various positions of that boom, and depending on that particular velocity profile, that gives you a particular antenna pattern. You then have control of the beam width of the main lobe, the amplitudes of the side lobes, the front-to-back level, the front-to-back ratio, a hell of a lot of the characteristics of the antenna pattern of the Yagi antenna are almost completely controllable by the velocity factor along each particular position along the long boom of that Yagi. Does that make some sense, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW.
You were talking about the causes. You were talking about the effects. You didn't talk about the causes. At least I didn't understand that this way. I'm going to give you a quote from Dr. Roy. Only particles with their rest mass can travel at the speed of light in a vacuum. Object with real non-zero rest mass can never be accelerated to the speed of light in a vacuum. The energy required to accelerate them using the appropriate Lorentz transform would require infinite amount of energy. Now, if there is a different velocity, that must be a force that makes that different velocity happen. And it must be a different environment or different medium, so all of those photons will then have a different speed. So that's where my confusion is starting. Enter here.
Now you're using Newtonian type understanding of particles with mass. I can tell you for a fact that I have 99% confidence in what I'm about to say. Light traveling through air has a very predictable velocity. When that light enters the glass of my magnifying glass, it will slow down to a very predictable number instantaneously. So as the light progresses through my glass lens, my magnifying glass, it's at a much lower velocity. At the instant the light exits the other end of my magnifying glass, it instantaneously jumps right back to the velocity of light in air. Those particles act almost like there is no mass to them. The velocity of light in air and glass is very predictable, and there is no slow speed up and slow down as it enters the glass and as it leaves the glass. So the velocity factor of the signal in that glass and that air is 1 over the dielectric constant, square root of the dielectric constant. That's the velocity factor. And you could make believe the photons have no mass. And in that real environment that you and I could measure, you will reconfirm that velocity factor. Back to you for a final on this one now, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
You have an antenna that is surrounded by the same density of the medium. You have a different part of antennas, of that antenna that produce different velocity of the photons. That velocity seems to not be dependable up to the properties of the medium, but up to the antenna design and the reflectors, the parts of the antenna that launch those photons at different speed. That's what you're postulating? And to XGN?
I can make a magnifying glass at radio frequencies by starting off with a great big chunk of low-density foam, and I can bury washers in that foam, and I change the density of the washers. Near the center of the foam, I put a whole lot of washers. Out at the perimeter of the foam, I put very few washers. I am synthesizing a slow-wave structure by putting washers in that foam at RF frequencies. If I boil that down to the microscopic level, you could say Mother Nature's atoms of that glass, of that magnifying glass, are doing that. In the case of my Yagi, individual directors, if I make the director short, it is capacitive. It's a slow wave structure. If I make the director longer than the resonant length, it's inductive. It's a fast wave structure. By modulating the length of each of the directors and the spacing between the directors, I can, in a local area, I can create a velocity factor that I have control of. I can control the velocity factor of that portion of the RF wave that goes down the Yagi in the vicinity of the boom. Each of those elements are a structure that I can control their resonant frequency, I can control their velocity factor, and whether I'm doing it with a coke lens, that's a big chunk of foam with washers, let me drop.
Dick, you're not saying how you're doing it. You're saying the effect. You're saying that you can do it. I believe you. You're not saying electronically how do you do it. So you can start from the nuclear level of the photons, from the origin of the photons, or you can
quick comment, Dick.
The origin of the phenomena that you're trying to tell us. And to XGN.
I did tell you how I'm doing it. By adjusting the length of the elements, I make them inductive or capacitive. That's adjusting their apparent velocity factor in that region and changing the spacing elements. The thing that I adjust, that adjusts the local velocity factor, is the length of the directors and the spacing of the directors. That gives me control of the local velocity factor. John's got a comment on this one. Go ahead, John.
Dick, in this relatively long boom that you're describing on this Yagi, couldn't we recreate the same experience with coaxial cable of different types in series? Couldn't we reproduce the same exact function?
I could if I wanted to start off with a long piece of coax cable where I break it up into individual sections, and the individual sections have high or low dielectric constant insulating material between center conductor and shield, where I can do it with waveguide. I've got waveguide where I'm putting various densities of foam inside the waveguide, so I can make a length of waveguide that has different velocity factors and different sections of the waveguide, absolutely. Unfortunately, that is not an antenna. The waveguide is a shielded structure. The coax cable is a shielded structure. I'm trying to capture signals from outer space, so to speak, or from over that horizon. I'm trying to capture those signals. And by my local individual regions of my antenna, let me drop. By me controlling the local velocity factor of various portions along the length of my antenna in the Z direction, I can control velocity factors and I can generate an antenna pattern. Whether I'm transmitting or receiving doesn't matter because of reciprocity. I can control the antenna pattern. I can do the same velocity factor modulation in waveguide or coax. Unfortunately, that's not an antenna because that's a shielded structure. It's not gathering signals from the outside world. In theory, I can now build a piece of coax cable or a piece of waveguide where I've got a whole lot of slots in it, so it's a leaky wave structure, so that when I'm transmitting, signal leaks out from those slots as it goes through various regions of that waveguide that have various densities of foam and velocity factor. And yes, with some difficulty, I could make a Yagi-like antenna out of a long piece of waveguide or a long piece of coax, which got a bunch of slots that are leaking the signal, and I'm controlling the velocity factors inside. I'm not saying that would be a great antenna, but it is possible. I can see a lot of difficulty of doing it that way. The Yagi-like structure out in free air does it so much more nicely, with so much less material, and it's got a lot of history, and it works like a charm once you understand the principle. KT2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, I was just saying that we could have the same velocity factor changes in different coax cables and reproduce the same amount of area and the increase and decrease in photon transmission. That's all I was pointing to, but yes, I understand. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
I have a question for help from John. Did John understand me better? So at first, John, do you understand how on molecular level or the photon level, velocity is being translated to the length of the elements and the role of the elements in the antenna? John, pick up.
KC2WGB. Well, Wes, all I understand is what Dick is saying, whether we adjust the elements to be capacitive or inductive. Are we having a fast wave or slow wave? That's how it's developed right down the line of the boom, from my understanding. But I could be misunderstanding, too. Back to you, Dick.
This is like you saying, yeah, I push the pedal and I'm accelerating my motor in my car. I'm asking you, what is happening when you press the pedal? Back to you, John.
I'm going to give you some words on this.
I'll leave that up to Dick. He's the antenna specialist. Go ahead, Dick. KC2WGB.
There's a whole science these days that's written a lot of articles in the last 10 years called metamaterials. Metamaterials contain step-and-repeat resonators. If I've got at the sub-wavelength level a bunch of individual resonators, and I lay them out in a two-dimensional or three-dimensional matrix manner, depending on the individual resonant frequencies of the individual elements in this step-and-repeat two-dimensional or three-dimensional matrix, by metamaterials technique, individual resonators, high or low in frequency, and certain couplings between them because of their spacings, I can now synthesize a metamaterial that has any dielectric constant you want. I can generate dielectric constants that are negative and positive. And so metamaterials are the modern science by which it's being done in substrates of printed circuit boards. A Yagi antenna is the early equivalent of that. The individual elements of the Yagi antenna are like the individual resonators in a metamaterial. When you study the way a radio wave propagates, let me drop. Whether that radio wave is moving through your sheet of metamaterial, or whether it's moving through free space going down the boom of your Yagi, the individual resonators with their individual resonant frequencies, with their individual spacings, by the laws of physics, generates the local velocity factor. So the factor that makes a metamaterial work and the factor that makes a Yagi work is probably almost the exact same phenomenon. You are synthesizing a local dielectric by having sub-wavelength chunks of resonator with certain coupling coefficients laid out in a certain volumetric manner. It makes a local velocity factor by the metamaterial technique. Over to you for a final on this one, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
The beginning of everything is a force. So my understanding, what you're trying to say is by comparison of metamaterials to the elements of your Yagi antenna is that the amount of force delivered to those individual elements of the antenna vary with strength, or with power, or with force values. By that, there is less force that is producing the less of the speed. I'm trying to get a sense of what you're saying. Get to it here.
If I go down to the atomic level of the molecules that make up the glass of my magnifying glass, I could call that a metamaterial. The individual atoms and molecules in that glass are considerably smaller than the wavelength of the light that I'm sending through the glass. The way those individual molecules behave, their individual dielectric constant, their individual spacing, you could call them resonators. And the spacing and the character of the individual molecules of the glass generates, in a manner similar to a metamaterial, it generates a local velocity factor of light. I would not use the word force. Force means that you're moving particles that have mass. You could make believe the photons of light have no mass, and you'll come up with a more accurate answer. You could make believe that the photons of the radio wave have no mass, and you'll come up with the right answer. There isn't a force pushing them. The local velocity, the local dielectric constant, the local velocity factor is generated in that manner in glass, and in a very similar manner, even though it looks different, the individual elements, which are the atoms, let me drop.
We need Dr. Roy to take a stand on it if he's here later on, but we could do it this way, that we could leave it now, and next week I would like to come back to that and to it.
Okay, as a final comment, the individual atoms of the glass are local resonators of a metamaterial that synthesizes a certain velocity factor of that light flowing through that glass of my magnifying glass. The individual resonators of the directors of my Yagi are less than a wavelength in spacing, less than a wavelength in length, very similar to the molecules of the glass. They're less than a wavelength in diameters and lengths and spacings. So you can synthesize, by the metamaterial philosophy, any velocity factor you want, and the velocity factor can be made to jump up and down any way you want, because you could make believe the photons have no mass, and whether they're photons of light or photons of radio waves, make believe they have no mass. There is no force required. The velocity of that signal, let me drop.
Without the force, there is no photon. Without origination, there is not the effect of that origination. Enter here.
At the absolute microscopic level, you're probably right. But if you make believe the photons have no mass, you'll come up with the right answer most of the time. Same thing with those photons of radio wave. Make believe it has no mass. When you traverse from one medium to another, the new speed of that light, the new speed of that radio wave, changes instantaneously. If there was a substantial amount of mass to those photons, it wouldn't do that. It does that. You can run as many experiments as you want. That light wave leaving the glass, jumping over to air, instantaneously jumps to the new higher velocity factor of air. It acts as if it had no mass. That gives you the right answer. How you explain that light does it, whether or not it's really got a small amount of mass, and where's the force coming from, that's a deep question. I don't think we can answer that one. We've got to move on. John, is there anything else that we should discuss before we go over to the real exciting stuff of this gravity wave detection? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
No, I'm all for it, Dick. I want to hear it also. It sounds like interesting stuff. So it's KC2WGB, complete with the mailbag.
Now, we radio amateurs are trying to ride the coattails of Joe Taylor, K1JT, because he is, if you read enough of the articles about this gravity wave detection, he's the man who made the first detection of gravity waves. Joe Taylor, along with Russell Holt, way back in 1974, making measurements at Arecibo, the 1,000-foot diameter dish in Puerto Rico, where they discovered a pulsar, where the rate of the pulsar was going up and down cyclically. And they said, aha, that pulsar is in orbit around some other object. It was a binary star system. another star, a binary star system, but they were smart enough to make the measurement over a long enough period of time that they saw the rate of change of the pulsar going up and down in rate. They saw the pulsar, the rate at which the pulsar was going up and down represents the spacing of the orbit, and they saw that the orbit was decaying. The orbit was becoming smaller and smaller. The rate was going up. Whenever something goes in orbit around something that's closer, the orbital period becomes a lower number. The orbital velocity goes up, so to speak. And they saw that happening, and they said the only way that could be happening is it's radiating gravity waves. So they made an indirect measurement and got a Nobel Prize for doing it. Whenever you go to any of the lectures of Joe K1JT, quite often he brings along that Nobel Prize, and he passes it around the audience. And for some reason, he's real careful to collect it at the end. I don't quite understand it. The solid chunk of gold. Let me drop it. That in Stockholm, Norway, the president of the country put this beautiful medallion around his neck. And whenever he passes it around the audience, he then collects it. But he made the very first indirect measurement of gravity waves. He's given credit for doing that. And now last September, on September 14th at 5 o'clock in the morning, when the new supersensitivity of LIGO was turned back on, all of a sudden, in a very short period of time, they saw this chirp signal. And the chirp signal, at first you would say, yeah, maybe it's a glitch, or maybe somebody's running a test. But the exact same chirp occurred both in Hanford, Washington, and in Louisiana. All of a sudden I've forgotten the name of the place in Louisiana, where these two places, 1,887 miles apart, got the exact same signal. 7 milliseconds delayed in time toward Hanford, Washington. And so there was a beautiful piece of measurement which they studied it for 6 solid months before reporting it. And they published a whole bunch of articles about what they saw and what it means. So this is the beginning of gravity wave detection, a brand new window on making astronomy measurements. It's going to be a long time before you hear the end of this one. WS2N, give us a brief transmission, see how well you're coming through tonight, Paul. WS2N with the Space Report, and this is going to be Space Report number 188, K2RW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, it is 188, and this is WS2N, and had a discussion with John, KC2WGB, earlier in the week about this topic, and I saw that it was going to be coming out a couple of days later, and sure enough, it did make the news. So how's my transmission, Dick?
Beautiful. Please proceed. And remember, once every minute and a half to interrupt so we don't time out the machine.
I will try. Very good. You're right in everything you said about the LIGO system. With Livingston, by the way, and LIGO stands for laser interferometry, gravitational wave observatory. And they like to use the word gravitational. They physicists don't want to use the word gravity wave. They consider that something else. But nevertheless, the project started. They started looking for funding in the 80s, and I have a book here talking about the LIGO project before it was even built, and roughly, you know, the idea of how it was going to work with the 4-kilometer-long tubes or pipes in an L-shape form, you know, that they were going to send the light down the, you know, from the where the L part meets, hit the mirrors and come back, and they were going to detect the difference in the light when it returned through interferometry. Let me drop it. And the expected difference would be 1/1000th of a diameter of a proton. That's what they're talking about. Now in the book, it described that they were going to send it down back and forth through the mirrors many, many hundreds of times, where when you listen to the news, it makes it seem like it went down there once and came back. So right now, I'm not sure what the actual system is. at the right time. And it wasn't even tuned up properly. I mean, they expect it to go three times more sensitivity in the near, very near future. So they expect to get a lot more signals coming in. In the book, I was talking about one of the head physicists is Kip Thorne, and he's been around for a long time, and he's very popular in the physics community. In fact, when Paramount wanted to make the movie Interstellar, they got a hold of him and tried to make the movie as realistic as possible using some of his theories. You know, he guided them to you know, what they should do and what they shouldn't do in the movie. But he was on the dais when they were interviewing, and they had a news conference in Washington at the National Science Foundation, and sure enough, he was there. I'm sure he's very happy with the results that did turn up. So, you know, now we talked about another project that was being sent up by a spacecraft called, not LIGO, but LISA. And we spoke about this on the net back in December when it was launched, one of the earlier nets here. It was launched from French Guiana, and it's a precursor to another spacecraft that's going to be launched, some very similar, but you know, similar theories on how this machine is going to operate, but it's going to be much more elaborate, of course. This is really a test vehicle that was sent out to the L1 position, 1 million miles away from Earth, between the Sun and the Earth. And in fact, it just got there at the end of January. It was launched in December. It takes a long time to get there. And LISA, that's another acronym for laser interferometry. These are the same first two words. And then SA is space antenna. And this is within a contraption inside of a spacecraft. Maybe about 6 feet wide spacecraft. And it's going to be out at the L1 position, and the idea is to see if these cubes, they have two cubes that are floating around inside the spacecraft. And they're heavy, they're made of gold and platinum. And these two cubes are going to be floating inside, and they're going to be...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
This is also to detect gravitational waves, and they're going to eventually have three of these spacecraft 1 million miles apart from one another, and they're going to be sending signals back to one another. That's the goal. But to see if that works, they need to see if they can keep a cube so steady in space. You just put a spacecraft out there and shoot a laser at another spacecraft, even the solar wind or you know, any kind of different heating of the spacecraft on one side compared to the other will actually make the spacecraft move in space. So essentially, this spacecraft, LISA, has these cubes on the inside, and then the spacecraft, if the spacecraft moves one way or the other, the cubes won't detect the outside movement, so they'll stay exactly in the same position. That's the theory anyway. And they have these very fine thrusters on board made by NASA to keep these things very steady. And they're going to start operation probably beginning of March to see if this whole system works. And eventually they'll have an outboard space gravitational wave detector that will actually be able to detect lower frequencies than what can be done on Earth. So that's the goal. But a lot going on with gravitational waves, Dick. I'll turn it back to you. There's other things I wanted to go over on, you know, different things happening in space, but I'm sure you want to cover this. to some degree. K2RIW, WS to ask.
Yeah, as you dig into the article, and Roy gave me a reference for a very nice article in one of the science journals about the LIGO. LIGO sends a beam down two tunnels that are 4 kilometers long. Excuse me, those two tunnels are at right angles to each other, each one 4 kilometers long, and the tunnel is as best as the vacuum they can make, so there's not so the laser beams are not hitting light, not hitting air molecules. The laser beam bounces back and forth between two mirrors at opposite ends of the 4 kilometer vacuum tunnel, bounces back and forth 400 times. Then the signal on the north-south tunnel, 400 times bounce, and the signal on the east-west tunnel, 400 times bounce, get mixed together in a Michelson interferometer, and the two interferometers are adjusted to be a nearly perfect null into the sector. So that if anything changes the apparent length of the east-west tunnel or the north-south tunnel, the null on that interferometer gets lost. The detector says, aha, I see a signal. And that's the beginning of the sine wave of a gravitational wave detection, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And I had great difficulty trying to find a website where I could see the live newscast that was done at 10:30 in the morning on Thursday. They announced for a few days ahead of time there's going to be a great big announcement by the National Science Foundation, 10:30 in the morning on Tuesday, and I couldn't find a website that would give me a live feed, but I found a bunch of websites downrange in time that would play it back for me. The president of National Science Foundation, a lady, can't think of her name, made the beginning of the presentation. This particular project of LIGO was the most expensive project that the National Science Foundation has ever funded. They put forth a hell of a lot of money, quite a few billion dollars, into this LIGO project because they saw great potential in it. For a while, they were getting quite a bit of flack from people saying, gee, National Science Foundation, this is public money, and you're wasting it on this project that has no chance of success. They were getting a lot of flack like that for a while. Now they've hit pay dirt. And so, very successful, long-range, dark horse project that worked out. And just to give you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on here, let me drop. These two black holes, one of them is 36 suns is one and the other one is 29. So combined, they're 65 solar masses. So 36 solar masses and 29 solar masses. That means each one of them is in the vicinity of 180 miles in diameter. You take something that's the size of the sun, close to 1,000,000 miles in diameter. In the case of our sun, if you compressed it down to 6,000 meters, 6 kilometers, it would be a black hole. Although, under natural conditions, it takes more than 3 solar masses to form a supernova that will give you a black hole. So, these two black holes, how did they get as big as they are, 36 solar masses and 29 solar masses? They probably are the combination of other black holes, very similar to this particular event. When these two black holes came together, they're each in the vicinity of 180 miles in diameter, and they were spaced by not much more than that, real close to each other. At the end of that, orbiting each other in collision, they were moving at half the speed of light. And when they came together, they made this this chirp signal. The chirp is a raise in frequency as they move faster and faster in real speed, faster and faster in real period, you know, lower and lower period time. And that gave you that chirp signal. And after they combined, the 65 solar masses you began with ended up as 62 solar masses. 3 solar masses were lost. We dropped. And all the articles say that the 3 solar masses resulted from the gravitational waves being transmitted. Well, I've got another theory on this one. I'm going to throw out a theory. Sure, it would be nice if somebody confirmed it at some downrange. The most exciting events that are in astronomy that have ever been measured from one point of view gamma ray bursts. No matter what detector you put out there, if a gamma ray burst comes along, it's probably going to saturate your detector. I'm going to give you a little bit of a feeling for what is a gamma ray burst. That sun that you and I care an awful lot about is putting out a tremendous amount of power. Here we are 93 million miles away from it. Each square meter of black material you put out there in the sun sucks up 1.3 kilowatts of solar energy. 1.3 kilowatts of solar energy is the approximate solar flux that we see 93 million miles away. And by the laws of inverse square law, you can calculate what's going on right at the sun. The sun is putting out 10 to the 27 watts. One with 27 zero out of it is the number of watts it's putting out. And it does that 24/7, 365 days a year for the last 5 billion years. The estimation is the sun is going to last for 10 billion years. We're halfway through that life. We're 5 billion years into a solar thing, a solar star, our local star that's going to last for 10 billion years. At the end of the 10 billion years, if you added up all the energy over the 10 billion years, you get 10 to the 44 joules, 10 to the 44 watt seconds. 10 to the 27 watts is being put out, and over 10 billion years, it ends up as 10 to the 44 joules. In the case of a gamma ray burst, by the way, that sun of ours is going to put out that amount of energy over 10 billion years. In the case of a gamma ray burst, whatever the hell it is, you get that amount of energy in a fraction of a second. Imagine this is just one solar mass converting all of the energy of that sun going to be giving you for 10 billion years nuclear fusion. 10 billion years of nuclear fusion, you can compress all of that energy into a fraction of a second. That's a gamma ray burst. If that happens within 22 light years of where you and I live, it's game over. It'll toast everything on planet Earth. Gamma ray bursts, a rough estimate is you get one of those per galaxy, per century. Rough guess. So there's a whole lot of...
Repeater, time out.
There's a whole lot of gamma ray bursts you get out there from all kinds of crazy directions. And so this particular solar event, this particular gravitational wave event occurred 1.3 billion light years away, 1.3 billion years ago. At the speed of light, gravitational waves got to us. Give you a little bit of a feeling for what that is. Our galaxy, our 10 to the 11 stars, are in a great big disk, and that disk has something in the vicinity of 150,000 light years of diameter. The nearest local galaxy is Andromeda. It's a little bit bigger than us. It's around 250,000 light years in diameter. The Andromeda galaxy is 2.5 million light years away from us. 2.5 million light years away is the Andromeda galaxy. This gravitational wave event took place 1.3 billion years light years away. So that is what? 100 times or 1,000 times further than the Andromeda galaxy. We're detecting gravitational waves from a distance, many times the distance between our galaxy and Andromeda. So it's in some galaxy a long distance away. Let me drop it. So had that event been inside of the Andromeda galaxy, the signal we would have gotten probably would have been thousands of times louder. If it happened in our galaxy, probably that gravitational wave signal would have been millions of times louder. So these guys had a very difficult challenge to listen to a pretty potent gravitational wave ripple signal, but it occurred a very long distance away. The whole damn universe is only 13.7 billion light years in radius, and 1.3 billion light years away was this event that they detected. So quite a bit of success. It's just the beginning of what's going to be an exciting new window we've got in the world of astronomy to try to let you know what's going on. They're predicting that as they make more and more of these measurements with more and more sensitivity, and this other gravitational wave detectors that